in the limelight.
The new Zionist regime's government has started a new wave of violent attacks against Palestinians since the beginning of 2023. Also, Zionist settlers, encouraged by the far-right Zionist government of Netanyahu, have intensified their attacks against innocent Palestinians. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International noted, living up to their murderous nature, Zionist occupiers massacred in cold blood 10 Palestinians in the Jenin refugee camp on January 26th. Among those shot and killed was a 60-year-old Palestinian grandmother, Magda Obeid. She was shot in the neck. The Palestinian Health Ministry said Sa'eb Issam Mahmoud, Israeli, 24, and Ezzedine Yassin Salaha, 26, were also killed in the early morning of the Zionist regime's assault on Jenin. Another 20 Palestinians were wounded. Four of them were reported to be in critical condition. The Zionist assault on the refugee camp was carried out using a ruse. Heavily armed troops entered the camp riding in a commercial truck to hide their identity. As they entered the camp, the Zionists opened fire on residents who realized what was going on and attempted to block their entry. Several other army vehicles, including bulldozers, followed the commercial vehicle and attacked a building used as a meeting place for residents. Quoting Anas Hawaisha, a Palestinian correspondent at a local channel in Jenin, the Middle East Eye reported the sounds of bullets and gunfights were intense and clouds of smoke covered the sky. The Israeli occupation cut off the electricity, the internet, and the cell phone network during the storming. This shows that it was planned. The Zionists entered Jenin near the area of Jorat al-Hab. When the Palestinians discovered that the Israelis were attacking, they sounded the alarm to alert their residents of the camp. There was an exchange of fire between Palestinian fighters and the Israeli troops, and then more forces were pushed into the camp, Hawaisha said, adding, tens of military vehicles laid a siege around the area. True to their lying nature, the Zionists claimed they were targeting fighters who, according to their intelligence reports, were planning attacks. The Zionist occupiers have seldom needed any excuse to murder innocent Palestinians. After all, at least 29 Palestinians have already been murdered this month. This murder rate surpasses even the horrendously high figures for 2022, when more than 250 Palestinians were murdered by the occupation forces. And why did the occupiers prevent Red Crescent medical workers from evacuating the wounded by restricting access to the refugee camp? Palestinian Health Minister Mai Al-Kaleh said that the Israeli regime forces stormed Jenin government hospital and intentionally fired tear gas canisters at the pediatric department in the hospital. Video footage showed the Israeli regime fire tear gas, choking women and children inside the pediatric department. Were these women and children also planning to attack the Zionist murderers? Ever since the new fascist cabinet has taken charge, led by the indicted criminal Benjamin Netanyahu, attacks on Palestinians have escalated. Such notorious terrorists as Itamar Ben-Gvir, Bezalel Smotrich, Avi Moz, and Yariv Levin in the Israeli regime cabinet have vowed to kill more Palestinians. Zionist criminals established their credentials by killing and maiming Palestinians. Meanwhile, Wafa News Agency reported hardcore Israeli settler fanatics on January 29th set on fire a house and parked a vehicle after sneaking into the town of Tormuz Aya to the northeast of Ramallah in the occupied West Bank, according to local sources. Awad Abu Samra, a resident of the town, told Wafa that a group of settlers backed by army militias sneaked into the town in the middle of the night before they set a parked vehicle on fire, completely destroying it and setting fire to the house of Mr. Odeh Jabara, a local Palestinian resident, causing partial damage to the external walls of the house. Meantime, groups of Zionist settlers stormed the nearby village of Duma and shattered at least one vehicle. The settlers also shattered the windows of a house in the village. These attacks are part of an ongoing wave of unabated settler violence encouraged by the new far-right Israeli regime government of Netanyahu and with incitement from his ultra-nationalist cabinet ministers Itamar Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. Also, Wafa reported Israeli regime forces stole artifacts from the village of Sebastia, north of the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Local sources said Mohammad Azam, head of the Sebastia municipality, said that the Zionist regime forces stole artifacts from the archaeological sites in the village. He added that the forces have been surrounding staff from the municipality and the Ministry of Tourism for hours.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The two biggest economies in South America are starting talks to create a common currency. Brazil's president, Luiz Inácio da Silva, and Argentina's president, Alberto Fernández, wrote in a joint piece published in Argentinian paper Perfil that they wanted to foster greater integration between the two neighbors. The pair said they had decided to move forward with discussions about a common South American currency that could be used for financial and commercial flows, reducing operating costs and other external vulnerability.
What we're trying to work on right now is to have our finance ministers, each with their economy teams and with a lot of debate and meetings, flow the foreign trade and transaction between the two countries with a common currency.
The announcement came as Lula has visited Argentina for his first trip abroad since taking office at the start of the month. At a press conference in Buenos Aires, he said establishing a common currency for trade would reduce reliance on the U.S. dollar, whose sharp ascent last year was painful for countries around the world. Lula said, "If it depended on me, we would have external commerce always in the same currency of the other countries so we wouldn't have to depend on the dollar." The Financial Times had previously reported, citing Argentina's economy minister Sergio Massa, that the neighboring nations would announce this week they were starting work on a common currency. Massa indicated that though initially a bilateral project, the initiative would be offered to other nations in Latin America, adding it's Argentina and Brazil inviting the rest of the region. Argentina and Brazil are both part of the Mercosur trade bloc, which also includes Paraguay and Uruguay. Talk of creating a common currency has periodically cropped up since its founding in 1991. Brazil is Argentina's largest trade partner. It's the top destination for Argentine exports, amounting to 14.3% and $12.7 billion in 2022. Close to 20% of Argentina's imports are from Brazil, worth just over $16 billion last year. Emerging markets have also been hit hard by the strong U.S. dollar, drawing complaints about its dominance in the global financial system. The greenback rallied nearly 8% against a basket of major currencies in 2022, making imports of food and energy more expensive.
The situation in Israeli-occupied East Al-Quds remains volatile after a number of shooting operations there took the lives of at least 9 people and wounded several others. In the latest incident, 2 Israelis were wounded in an operation in the Silwan neighborhood of Al-Quds on Saturday morning. The Israeli Emergency Medical Services said one of those injured was in critical condition. The shooter, identified as a 13-year-old Palestinian, was wounded. The incident was the second Palestinian operation in Al-Quds in less than a day. On Friday, at least 7 people were killed and several others wounded in a shooting operation outside a synagogue in the Israeli-occupied East Al-Quds. Resistance movements hailed the operation. The Al-Quds Brigades, which is the military wing of the Islamic Jihad movement, praised the attack as a courageous operation. It said the attack was a natural response to the Israeli occupation and the regime's crimes against Palestinians. The Al-Quds Brigades said the operation is a testament to unity among resistance groups. Hamas also lauded the operation. The movement said the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will pay the price for any new mistake that Tel Aviv could make. Lebanon's Hezbollah and Yemen's Ansarullah movement also separately praised the action. The Friday incident followed a Thursday Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank, where at least 10 Palestinians were killed in cold blood by Israeli troops. Thursday marked the deadliest day for the Palestinians since the start of the new year. Israeli troops barred medical teams from reaching the area. Regime forces also stormed a hospital in Jenin and intentionally fired tear gas towards its pediatrics department. Separately, Israeli forces demolished a sports club in the refugee camp. All what is going on in the occupied territories is happening in the silence of the international community. The mainstream media closed its eyes to the deadliest Israeli raid on the Palestinian community in the occupied land this year, and instead, they took the side of the Israelis in the recent tensions. From the United States to Germany, to France and Ukraine, almost everyone expressed concern about the lives of Israelis during the recent violence. The storming of the Jenin refugee camp is indicative of the regime's aggressive nature in dealing with Palestinians, especially since the emergence of extremist ideologies in the Israeli cabinet. Many argue that the current Israeli cabinet is the most extremist ever since its installation in the occupied land. What highlights this extremism is the recent storming of the Al-Aqsa Mosque by Israeli far-right Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir. Many brand the minister's move as the root cause of all the recent tensions between Israelis and the Palestinians in the occupied territories. The latest flare-up of Israeli violence in the occupied West Bank brings to the question the regime's motive behind such escalations. One presumption is that the regime is only after taking out the total Palestinian identity from their land. In order to do that, what could be better than suppressing them by imposing an all-out blockade on millions of Palestinians and blocking their access to the outer world? To support that presumption, it is enough to say that the Israeli cabinet is planning to deport Palestinian families, at least those who the regime deems as terrorists, from their own land. That's why it pushes ahead with its policy of demolishing Palestinian homes. Many are convinced that this amounts to utter collective punishment and ethnic cleansing. There is no doubt that what the Israeli regime is doing now in the occupied land, in terms of demolition and other practices, will definitely backfire. What could be around the corner for the Israeli occupying regime is yet another intifada waiting to happen. After all, Palestinian resistance has entered a new phase, and so many young people are taking part in the operations against the Israeli regime. Grassroots Palestinians with no affiliation to any of the resistance groups are rising against the regime, like the Den of Lions. The Den of Lions is an independent armed Palestinian group operating in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. The group emerged in August 22 following the killing of a Palestinian man by Israeli forces. Anti-Netanyahu rallies are being held on a weekly basis, with protesters not caring about what is happening to the Israelis in the occupied land, but rather taking aim at a prime minister who is indicted on grave charges and is willing to evade laws to do whatever he can. All in all, point to a situation where things are pulling the Israeli cabinet apart and move the regime to an ultimate annihilation.
In an article published on Responsible Statecraft, it is said that the U.S. role in Ukraine has slowly escalated since the beginning of the war there almost a year ago, saying the question now is how far Washington is willing to go. When the U.S. involves itself in a conflict, it often finds it difficult to get itself out. For instance, it happened in Vietnam. The U.S. military advisors helping the South Vietnamese fight Viet Cong forces eventually became U.S. soldiers fighting an American war. Or in Afghanistan, an initial invasion under the pretext of fighting Al-Qaeda terrorists morphed into 2 decades of war and destruction that resulted in the death of hundreds of thousands of Afghans. The same scenario could be unfolding in Ukraine. Less than a month into the Ukraine war, the US President Joe Biden stated that the US and NATO allies would not fight Russia in Ukraine. However, little by little, Washington and NATO are creeping closer to the catastrophic scenario Biden had described as World War III. Biden had also claimed the U.S. troops will not be sent to Ukraine to take part in the conflict. However, several current and former American intelligence officials told The Intercept back in October that there is a much larger presence of both CIA and U.S. special operations personnel in Ukraine than there was when the war began, saying they are conducting clandestine American operations in the country that are now far more extensive. An 8-year Army Special Operations veteran, who is now an investigative journalist, reported in December that among those covert operations is the CIA's work with an unnamed NATO allies spy agency to carry out sabotage operations within Russia. Reportedly, the cause of the unexplained explosions that have rocked Russian infrastructure throughout the war. Meanwhile, the United States and its NATO allies have serially blown past their own self-imposed lines over arms transfers. At the start of the war, analysts cautioned that the overt supply of even small arms and light weaponry risks encouraging a wider war and possible retaliation from Moscow, while U.S. officials ruled out more advanced weaponry as too escalatory. It took less than 2 months for the Biden administration to start sending these more risky tranches of high-powered arms. By the end of May, it was sending advanced rocket systems. In addition, NATO arms transfers have now escalated well beyond what governments had worried just months ago could draw the alliance into direct war with Russia, with the US and European governments now sending armored vehicles and planning to send tanks. Russia has warned the United States against its planned delivery of Abrams tanks to Ukraine. Anatoly Antonov, Russia's ambassador to the United States, has described the move as a blatant provocation against Moscow. He accused Washington of purposefully trying to inflict a strategic defeat on Russia. The warning came before the U.S. announced the delivery of dozens of its main battle tanks to Ukraine. Two American officials have been quoted as saying that the timeline of any potential delivery remains unclear and could take months or even years. Washington has said previously that providing Abrams tanks to Ukraine is not feasible, citing difficulties in training and maintenance. Meanwhile, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has decided to send Leopard 2 tanks to Ukraine and to allow other countries such as Poland to send the same tanks from their own stockpiles to Kyiv. Until now, Berlin had been hesitant to send the Leopards or to allow other nations that have them in their possession to transfer them to Kyiv, with reports early last week saying that Germany would agree to do so only if the US provided its own tanks. The decision by the U.S. to send its Abrams seems to have provided the political cover that Berlin had been seeking. Ukrainian officials have said the tanks would be a game-changer on the battlefield. The country's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has called for a large number of tanks to repel Russian attacks.
Today, by the way, there's a lot of talk about tanks, about modern tanks that we need, and about the way this shortfall can be filled. A lot of efforts, words, promises. But it is important not to lose sight of reality. It is not about 5 or 10 or 15 tanks. The need is larger.
Zelensky said that Ukraine's allies have the required number of tanks to strengthen the country's defense against Russia. Since the beginning of the war, Ukraine's allies have sent Kyiv tens of billions of dollars worth of weapons. Western countries have also imposed a slew of economic sanctions on Moscow. Now, by escalating their support for Ukraine's military, the US and NATO have created an incentive structure for Moscow to take a drastic, aggressive step to show the seriousness of its own red lines.
The confrontation between Russia and the West is getting more complicated after Germany and the United States announced their decisions to send advanced tanks to Kyiv. The U.S. is sending 31 Abrams battle tanks to Ukraine. Biden told reporters at the White House that the tanks highlight America's enduring commitment to Ukraine.
Today, I'm announcing that the United States will be sending 31 Abrams tanks to Ukraine, the equivalent of one Ukrainian battalion. Secretary Austin has recommended this step because it will enhance the Ukraine's capacity to defend its territory and achieve its strategic objectives. The Abrams tanks are the most capable tanks in the world. They're also extremely complex to operate and maintain. So we're also giving Ukraine the parts and equipment necessary to effectively sustain these tanks on the battlefield.
The reversal of the U.S.'s previous position came after Germany said it will send 14 of its Leopard 2 tanks to Ukraine. Berlin has also given permission to partner countries to re-export other battle tanks to Kyiv. Biden has praised the decision by Germany and stressed on what he called Western unity against Russia. Germany was reluctant to send tanks to Ukraine and was waiting for the U.S. to take the front lead. Britain had earlier announced that it would give Ukraine its Challenger tanks. While Berlin was concerned about escalating the war, Washington cited logistical and maintenance challenges. Western nations had so far refused to give heavy armored vehicles to Ukraine. Kyiv is now pushing its Western allies to deliver fourth-generation fighter jets, such as the American F-16. But the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz says there is no chance of any fighter jets being sent to Ukraine, despite renewed calls for high-end aircraft. Ukraine's Air Force has a fleet of aging Soviet-era fighter jets. Western military support has been vital for Kyiv.
I follow the debate closely surrounding these tanks. You know, you do have a number of German officials and experts, commentators saying we can't have German tanks, you know, on the border with Russia again. This evokes terrible memories of World War II. But the counter argument to this is, because you hear a lot about Russia, is if you look at how Nazi Germany invaded the Soviet Union, it invaded it through Ukraine and Belarus. So Germany also has a historic responsibility.
By announcing its decision to send Leopard tanks to Ukraine, Germany is now actively involved in the war with Russia. The German foreign minister has said that Germany and its allies are, quote, fighting a war against Russia. Comments have been described as rare and frank remarks about the Western role in the conflict. Sergei Nechayev, Russia's ambassador to Germany, said this extremely dangerous decision takes the conflict to a new level of confrontation and contradicts the statements of German politicians about Germany's unwillingness to get involved in it. Russia has harshly criticized the decision by NATO members to send heavy weaponry to Ukraine as a blatant provocation. The Kremlin has said that any Abrams battle tanks supplied to Ukraine by the U.S. would, quote, burn. Russian officials have dismissed the expected delivery as an expensive folly. The U.S. Defense Department announced in early January 2023 that it would give an additional $3.1 billion in military aid to Ukraine. In total, the U.S. approved about $50 billion in aid for Ukraine in 2022. About half of that money, or $24.9 billion, went towards military spending. The U.S. also gave $9.6 billion to Ukraine for what it has described as non-military purposes in 2022. It is believed that the small number of Western-supplied tanks manned by poorly trained crews and lacking maintenance and supply infrastructure support is likely to yield negative results. Furthermore, the first deployment of U.S. main battle tanks in Ukraine must come by a significant Ukrainian army success. That would require no fewer than 200 to 300 tanks. The question is whether Western countries are prepared to go for a full-blown confrontation with Russia.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember in the previous episode, we discussed the events leading to the acceptance of the United Nations Security Council Resolution 598 by the Islamic Republic of Iran after Imam Khomeini's permission. The resolution had in fact included some conditions for a just ceasefire of the Iraq-Iran war. We said that Iran had not accepted the former resolutions due to neglecting Iran's rights and being far from realities on the ground. Today, we are going to talk about the events before Imam Khomeini's passing away. Stay tuned, please. Nowruz of the new Iranian year 1368, March 1989, was a special event for the Iranian people as they were going to celebrate the first Nowruz after the end of the eight-year imposed war. Nowruz feast had coincided with the anniversaries of Imam Hussein, Hazrat Abbas, and Imam Sajjad, peace upon them. Hence, people had decorated the streets and alleys more than ever. According to the custom of every year, people were waiting to watch Imam Khomeini's live message on the new Iranian year. A few days earlier, the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting, IRIB, had suggested recording the Imam's message and broadcasting it as a live TV message. But Imam Khomeini didn't accept the suggestion, saying, "If I am alive, I will say the congratulation myself. But if I am not alive, this will be taken over by the next leader of the Leadership Council." The Imam's wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi, said on the issue after his passing away, "He would not accept even this much of dishonesty with people, so that the IRIB broadcast his pre-recorded message as live message." In those days, the Imam Khomeini's family was not that happy as the Imam was somehow ill. Lady Saghafi says, "I saw that the Imam had become weaker for a few days, and I noticed that he had gone to the clinic of Jamaran without informing me. I asked him, 'Why do you go to the clinic? What do they do with you?' He said, 'They take images from me.' I asked him, 'What has happened to you?' He said, 'My stomach was bleeding for a few days.' I was upset and told him, 'Why didn't you tell me anything?' He kept silent." Imam Khomeini's special physician, Dr. Arefi, heard of his illness. So he and his advisors started examining the Imam's stomach. Ms. Saghafi describes the issue. "Radiography began again, and one day it was clear that the Imam had been under the apparatus for long. So when he returned home, he was overtired. I realized that he had a tough time because I had experienced the exam a few years before and I knew how hard the exam was. So in order not to upset the Imam, I said, 'Inshallah, it is nothing and you will get better soon.' Yet I knew that a simple stomachache and even temporary bleeding shouldn't urge doctors to do exams so many times. The Imam didn't answer, and as it was the lunchtime, he ate a few spoons of the soup and went to his room to rest. The exams of physicians made them decide that Imam Khomeini had to undergo surgical operation. The Imam's wife was opposed to operation because he was very weak and she was worried that he might not endure it." She continues, "I was informed of the Imam's public health and said that there was no need for operation. I told Ahmad to ask the medical team to forget about surgery and told the Imam, 'You are too weak and cannot endure surgery.' He said, 'What can I do when they all say that I should be operated?' Finally, the day after the exams, doctors got Imam Khomeini's permission to hospitalize and operate him. The Imam was little satisfied to be operated, yet he surrendered to the view of physicians." Ms. Saghafi says, "That night, there was nobody at home except me and the Imam. Ahmad Agha and his wife came before the dinner. They went before the dinner. I had no appetite to eat the dinner, and the Imam ate just bread, yogurt, and cucumber. After the dinner, the brother, his daughter-in-law, Dr. Tabatabai, came. He was ready to accompany the Imam to the hospital. I said, 'I entrust you to God.' The imam came out of his room and told me to lock the door and take its key. Imam Khomeini went to the hospital. Ms. Saafi continues the story. We had lived together for 60 years. We might be upset with each other at times, but the imam would tell me repeatedly, "Be satisfied with me." Imam Khomeini went so fast that I failed to reach him. I was near the door of the clinic when he went down the steps and bid me farewell. I told him goodbye and came back with Fatima. Imam Khomeini passed away 2 weeks after hospitalization. Every detail of the operation could be watched by the family as there were cameras at the operation section. They were praying sadly. The imam was under operation, but he didn't forget prayer and supplication. He didn't forget religious obligatory acts. Ms. Saghafi told him, "I have come with you whenever you have gone, so take me to paradise with yourself." He said with a smile, "Thanks a lot for always being with me, but in the hereafter, everyone is alone with their deeds."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Men and women as human beings are completely equal in Islam. This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, meeting with hundreds of prominent Iranian women in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on January 4th, 2023. Mothers are a foundation for transferring the elements of national identity. National identity is something important. This is about the identity of a nation and a nation's character. This is primarily transferred by mothers. Things such as language, habits, manners, traditions, good morals, and good habits. All of these are primarily passed on by mothers. Fathers are also influential, but much less so than mothers. A mother has the greatest impact. She is the one who sprinkles the seeds of faith in hearts. It is mothers who raise children to be believers. Faith is not a subject to be taught or learned. Faith is something that grows. It is a spiritual growth that must be planted. It is the mothers who plant the seeds for it. The same goes for ethics. So a mother plays quite an extraordinary role. Now, these two roles are important. I have said this many times already, and it is something that I believe. These things are the main most important duties of a woman.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
One of the women here announced that she is a housewife. Well, that's very good. According to Islam, the main role of a woman is her role as a housewife. However, what's important is that being a housewife does not mean staying at home all the time. Some people make a mistake about this. When we say housewife, they think we mean that you should sit at home and do nothing, that you have no duties, you should not teach, you should not struggle on the path of God. And that you should not get involved in social work or political activities. That is not what being a housewife means. Being a housewife means taking care of your home, and alongside that, you can do any other work that you are able to manage, you are interested in doing, and you are enthusiastic about. However, all of these come after being a housewife. If you are caught in a situation where you have to choose between saving a child's life and working in an office, the child's life comes first. Do you have any doubts about this? No, no woman has any doubt that a child's life comes first.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Imam Khomeini, God's righteous servant. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, these days mark the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. We have prepared a special series on this occasion. The first episode will be a brief look at Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, as the great leader of this revolution. Stay tuned, please. Imam Khomeini had been sent to exile for more than 14 years due to his struggles against the British-installed and American-supported Pahlavi regime. The Imam was sent clandestinely to Turkey in 1964. After some 10 months, he was transferred to the holy city of Najaf in Iraq. The imam stayed in Najaf for more than 13 years, till the increase of pressures by the Shah of Iran, which forced him to change his residence from Iraq to the village of Neuf-le-Château near Paris. On February 1, 1979, Imam Khomeini's airplane took off toward Tehran. At time of entering Iran's air, a journalist asked the imam how he felt. Imam Khomeini answered indifferently, "Nothing." Unlike the leaders of uprisings and revolutions, who rejoice for triumph over their enemies, the imam said nothing, as he had acted according to his duty and for God's sake. So he would not get sad if he failed, and he didn't become happy when he triumphed. On February 1, 1979, the greatest and most glorious welcome in history was accorded to Imam Khomeini. The axis of victory of the Islamic Revolution was surely the unmatched leader who was ably and powerfully guided the nation better than any politician in the world. While religion had been quite isolated and pushed to the margin, Imam Khomeini followed the method of the Prophet of Islam and his infallible successors to liberate a nation from the yoke of colonialists and bullies of the world. He awakened the nation and granted self-esteem, self-confidence, and identity to them and other Muslim nations. The Imam presented a new system of governance on the basis of Islam within the structure of people's vote. Here, it should be noted that people's vote played a true role in Imam's view, opposite to the flawed and backward Western democracy, which only pretends to act on the basis of people's vote, while in practice, it is at the service of the owners of power. Imam Khomeini's successor, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, describes the Imam as follows. One of the titles and epithets which have been used less about our great Imam is this phrase. We always describe the Imam with numerous epithets, but this epithet, which we have described him rarely with it, is a comprehensive epithet. He is faithful, submissive servant, and revolutionary. Faithful means that he has faith in God. He has faith in the goal. He has faith in the path that takes him to this goal. And he has faith in people. It has been mentioned in the Quran about the noble prophet too. He had faith in God. Faith in the goal, faith in the path, and faith in people. He is a servant, a submissive servant. It means that he considers himself a servant before the Lord. This is a very important epithet. Look, God, the Exalted, has praised the noble prophet with numerous epithets in the Quran, each of which mentions an ample chapter of the Prophet's characteristics. But the epithet which we Muslims have been ordered to repeat every day in our daily ritual prayers on the Prophet is this: I bear witness that indeed Muhammad is his servant and apostle. This indicates the importance of servitude. Being a servant is so prominent that God the Exalted teaches Muslims this epithet to repeat it several times in their prayers every day. The Imam had such an epithet, the epithet of servitude. He was a man of humbleness. He was a man of pleading humbly. And he was a man of praying, a submissive servant. And as for the third epithet, that is revolutionary, the Imam was the Imam of the revolution. Imam Khomeini enjoyed a comprehensive godly personality. Therefore, upon his splendid return to the country, he opened new vistas of Islam before the contemporary man and presented Islam as a progressive religion which is capable of meeting all the demands of man in the modern world. The Iranian people had truly found their beliefs and ideals in his words and deeds. Therefore, they unanimously gathered around him. Imam Khomeini raised pure Muhammadan Islam as the new view on Islam, which includes every political, economic, cultural, and social aspect in human life. His take of Islam is a religion which fights the world oppressors and bullies in support for the oppressed and downtrodden in every country. The great leader of the Islamic Revolution believed that the way to the hereafter goes through this world. For him, both individual and social affairs mattered in order to help the individual and society grow. The Imam would never forget midnight prayer even when he was sick. On the night of flying to Tehran from Paris, while everyone was asleep, Imam Khomeini was performing midnight prayer on the upper floor of the airplane. Ayatollah Khamenei says, "What enabled the Imam to guide, administer, and lead this nation and this great revolution was his relation with God, his connection with God, his attention to God. He was truly God's servant, righteous servant. I cannot find a better epithet than this for Imam. He was a righteous servant."
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Latest surveys are indicating that more and more people in Italy are against continuing to send weapons to Kiev and are calling for a peaceful settlement of the conflict in Ukraine. According to a Euromedia poll, over half of Italians, about 52%, oppose supplying Ukraine with modern Western-made weapons, up several percentage points from mid-December. Furthermore, almost 7 out of 10 respondents were also against a possible intervention of NATO in the conflict.
Sending more weapons doesn't make any sense. More arms means more destruction and a never-ending war.
After weeks of doubts, Italy has confirmed it is ready to supply Ukraine with its highly costly SAMP/T air defense system. Italy only has 5 SAMP/T batteries, which has led to concerns over the weakening of the country's defense capability. Also, other polls show a growing opposition among Italians to an even more active role by the Giorgia Meloni government in the conflict. According to a survey commissioned by the state broadcaster RAI, an overwhelming majority of Italians, almost 80%, believe that the Ukraine conflict is far away from them. Another survey carried out by market research company SWG has revealed over half of Italian citizens oppose the government's plans to raise defense spending to 2% of GDP by 2028. Doing so would align the country with NATO's desired threshold.
I think that increasing our spending on weapons now is insane. We are already strangled by high inflation, high cost of living. I'm against the government's plan.
Italy counts very little at an international level. I am afraid it would be much more useful to remain inside the current international context and go with the flow.
Italy's next aid and military package to Ukraine is to be announced by the Meloni government in the early days of February. Max Civili, Rome.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has announced a series of punitive steps against Palestinians in response to Friday's shooting in East Al-Quds. The operation, which was carried out by 21-year-old Khaira Alqam from East Al-Quds, killed 7 Israeli settlers and wounded several others. The steps announced late on Saturday during a meeting of the Israeli cabinet included new moves to expand Jewish settlements. The cabinet, however, has not provided details on how settlements would be expanded. Other measures include granting gun permits to Israelis, a move seen as a green light to Israeli civilians' use of guns against Palestinians.
These are parts of more collective punishment, more aggression and crimes against Palestinians. They are speaking about home demolitions and stripping citizenship of the families of those who carry out such operations from the real owners of the land, and more such moves against the people of Al-Quds.
The cabinet also decided more punishments for the families of those who carry out shooting operations by deciding to demolish their homes. Early on Sunday, Israeli troops raided Attur neighborhood where martyr Khaira Alqam came from and sealed up the entrances of his family home in preparation for its demolition. The Israeli cabinet voted to revoke residency and citizenship rights of families of those who carry out shooting operations from Al-Quds and lands occupied in 1948.
The decisions of the Israeli cabinet are only about using much more violence, fierce violence against Palestinian people, and about consolidating the system of racial discrimination and occupation. Their decisions will not change much and will not break the Palestinian resistance. And in my opinion, this government is failing and will continue to fail because fascism cannot prevail. And nobody can break the will of the Palestinian people to struggle to be free.
Friday's operation came only one day after Israeli forces shot dead 9 Palestinians during a raid on a refugee camp in the northern West Bank city of Jenin. That brings to more than 30 the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces since the start of this year. Observers argue that the Israelis themselves should be now worried about the repercussions of the right-wing regime's policies, including the deadly raid on Jenin. They add that the Palestinians won't fear Netanyahu's further restrictions and collective punishment they already are used to under Tel Aviv's occupation. Mona Kandil for Press TV, occupied Ramallah.
Hundreds
hundreds of angered Muslim protesters converged on the Swedish embassy in London to condemn the recent